Charities have a responsibility to service users, communities, and wider audiences to avoid the spread of misinformation and to quell any false information relating to their cause. But misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories are increasingly widespread, the demarcation between real and unreal progressively blurred. Consider the US election, for example. Conspiracy theories and disinformation abound. Donald Trump has shared AI images of celebrity endorsements of Kamala Harris addressing a rally of communists, of himself riding a lion. He's shared an AI-generated video of him dancing to the Bee Gees with Elon Musk, and both of them in the false video can actually dance. It's not just the US. Over the past few years, we've seen deep fakes of Zelensky conceding and of Putin declaring peace. We've seen doctored images of NHS failings and misleading voting information. We've seen fabricated stories about outcomes of vaccines and political scandals. In fact, 94% of British people have encountered false information online, according to a recent study. The misinformation can and often does have profoundly serious effects, ranging from election interference to undermining trust to political violence. The difficulty in recent years is that despite the growth of misinformation and disinformation, social platforms seem less concerned with the protection of factually correct information, with many laying off staff members responsible for moderation or entire moderation teams. And governments seem unable or simply unwilling to implement any serious legislation. We've heard echoes from left and right and everyone in between that the onus is on the social media companies. All involved seem to believe in a fantastical notion of self-regulation, one that never worked for legacy media, one that cannot work for the vast and complex ecosystem of new media. Commitment to truth has been consistently undermined by people in power, by people on the fringes of power, and by people desperate to gain some form of social capital, money, or power. And all of us are susceptible to that false information, as we'll see in today's podcast. We underestimate our own vulnerabilities. We believe that it is only others that are vulnerable, which of course makes us all the more vulnerable. That's precisely why we all need to take steps to tackle misinformation. So, with that in mind, this podcast talks about the tools that aid prevention, the skills that provide empowerment, and the tips that can boost your judgment. So let's start with the first question. How and why do misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories spread? And what are the impacts? I will go first to Josie.
So we'll start with definitions of misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. So misinformation is when inaccurate information is spread by accident. Disinformation is when inaccurate information is spread deliberately in order to deceive and cause serious harm. And conspiracy theories are theories that explain an event or set of circumstances as a result of a secret plot by usually powerful conspirators, and that can be related to misinformation and disinformation. So the impacts of these three things can be, they can impact on health. So the World Health Organization says incorrect interpretations of health information can increase during pandemics, humanitarian crises, and health emergencies, often negatively impacting on people's mental health, increasing vaccine hesitancy and promoting unproven treatments. And it can also delay the provision of healthcare. And it can also impact on democracy and human rights. So, for example, inciting violence against minority groups and causing online harassment and psychological harm. So moving on to why misinformation, disinformation spread. Ever since there's been news, there's been false information. And one of the reasons is our human psychology. There's a lot of psychological concepts which make us susceptible. So one of them is cognitive miserliness, meaning we want to take the path of least resistance when solving problems and prefer not to question everything we hear. Fluency, people more likely to believe something that's true if they can process it fluently, for example, if something's repeated. Confirmation bias, which is a tendency to believe information that confirms our existing beliefs. Pluralistic ignorance, which is a lack of understanding about what others in society believe, and making people incorrectly think they're the majority when it comes to political view, when it's actually held by very few people. And third person effect, when people underestimate their own vulnerability to misinformation. There's also the role of platforms. So a 2022 New York Times article interviewed previous social media employees and misinformation experts. And they said the more ways there are for someone to go viral on a platform means misinformation is more likely to be distributed further. And other factors are when there's less steps to post on a platform and when the platform is more accurately able to predict and feed you what you want to see. And then finally, another reason why misinformation and disinformation spreads is because of the concept of news deserts. So that means a reduced quantity and quality of local news due to cutbacks and fewer journalists covering larger areas. And Public Interest News Foundation estimated that there's 28 news deserts in the UK. There's also the idea that people are using local community Facebook pages as opposed to reading their local news. So what they're missing out on in local news is the scrutiny and investigative nature of journalism as opposed to what you might find on a social media platform.
Cool. Well, thank you. Laura, do you want to add to that or...?
No, just that a lot of what Josie said just speaks to my experience generally, I would say. I think I was talking with a friend about this podcast last night, and we were saying how, like, the confirmation bias thing, you'll get something that appeals to, like, an emotion, and you'll go, oh, really? And it's almost like a cybersecurity impulse. You need to get over that emotion and think about it rationally before you can realize that that's misinformation, because it sort of it appeals to that part to fly under the radar, I think, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, Josie actually highlighted some of these to us, and she mentioned the vulnerability, that we're all vulnerable and that we often underestimate our vulnerability. And since then, I've been trying to effectively estimate my vulnerability. And it's just interesting because it's just such a strange phenomenon to kind of see everyone else on this sort of receiving end of fake news or whatever you want to call it, and sort of be like, I can't believe you believe this. And to consider that they're thinking the same about you is quite a strange scenario. And it makes, I suppose it makes us more perceptive and more cynical. And I suppose that's a good thing. Just on some of those things, I think with the social media platforms that Josie mentioned, I think it's worth talking about briefly what actually has happened over the last couple of years in these platforms. So Microsoft got rid of their ethics and society team in 2023. Twitter, or X as we all know, got rid of a lot of its moderation team and eschewed a lot of sort of long-held principles of safeguarding and protection against disinformation or hate speech, or however you want to contextualize it. Google, Amazon, and Meta all cut significant jobs, some of which included moderation. Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, YouTube, laid off half of its employees at a company called Jigsaw, which produced tools to combat disinformation and hate speech. And they quietly cut content moderators at YouTube. So it's funny because I feel like X led the way, or we perceive them to lead the way, in the sense of, like, they were quite open about cutting moderation because of Elon Musk's position as a sort of quote unquote free speech absolutist, as he seemingly doesn't know really what that means, but at the same time that's how he positions himself. And all these other companies have been doing a similar thing, but they do it quietly because they know that they kind of don't want the backlash from that, whereas he's been doing it quite loudly because he's trying to amplify that message. So it does make a far more kind of hostile landscape, I think, and it allows these things to go unnoticed and unchecked, really. How do we think AI is changing this conversation then? Does anyone want to take that away? Just on the basic level, I'm going to go to Laura. She made a face like, I'm not sure.
I think it's complicating things. I think it's making things harder to spot. So I think generally, particularly after, so we know it's not a new problem. Fake news was famously, I think it was word of the year in 2017 by the Collins Dictionary. And
new words, but sure.
Oh, well, I know, I thought the same, but I'm just reporting what they told me. I'm spreading some misinformation. So I think it's something that we've become a little bit more attuned to generally, but AI has absolutely complicated things. It's made it harder for people to spot. I think we've seen images where you're not sure if they are AI now, but people have posted them as legit. I think the best example is probably the one of the Pope a while ago, where he was wearing a puffer jacket. And I think people who are familiar with AI sort of knew it was AI, but I don't think that's, or did they not?
Well, I mean, I work and write about AI quite a lot, and read books on AI and study it in some way. And I thought he was wearing a bomber jacket. And I think that's kind of the point. I mean, we did a quiz in the office, didn't we, the other day, and I got 4 out of 8. Josie got 7 out of 8. I think Laura got 7 out of 8.
I did.
So well done to them, I suppose. But the point is that, I mean, I again work in AI, and I these things trick me all the time. And sorry to interrupt, but that was
No, I was agreeing.
But yeah, I think, and on top of that, I just think that the fact-checking elements are just so much more difficult. And it's so much more widespread as well. It's not just you have to fact-check one thing, it's you have to fact-check everything now. Because, you know, before, if you were fact-checking someone saying a statistic within a tweet, for example, that's fine. Now there could be every image you see could be a fake image. And that was just never something you had to grapple with as much before. You might have had to grapple with like Photoshop and stuff like that, but never in the same way. And it was usually a lot more obvious.
Yeah. And it's only if you're looking for it, really, because the thing in that AI test is that we were sort of looking for the exact, so no shadows in the back of pictures, for example. And deep fakes, you can see the sort of a weird lip movement. But if you're not looking for that, it's very subtle.
Mm.
And I think you could easily just believe that, because there's a couple of like TikTok deep fake accounts where it's just like silly things with celebrities, but obviously very bad. And yeah, I think if you're not looking for that stuff, I think AI can really fool you.
Yeah. And also it's only going to get better. I mean, it's position at this point, it's only going to grow more accurate and more capable of fooling us. So leads us to the next question. How can charities avoid misinformation? I'll start with Laura and then go to Josie. So avoid spreading misinformation, I should say.
Well, charities have a uniquely trusted voice. Their trust in charities is much higher than in other industries and sectors. 73% of people trust information about charities when it comes directly through their website. So charities have a place to speak directly to people about their cause. They need to maintain that, and that's by being above reproach, making sure that they have fact-checked everything, check their sources. We were again on AI. If you're using some tools like ChatGPT, the answers you're searching for don't appear by magic. They are pulled off the internet, but ChatGPT doesn't source it. You can ask for sources, I believe. I think Johan told me this. But they have been known to also make up their sources. Whereas Copilot connects to the internet. That's Microsoft's AI tool. That does connect to the internet and does source it, so you can see where things are coming from. But it's, again, not taking everything for granted. And maybe if you get a link through, going through separately to search into a search engine and looking up, but also being aware that Google now has AI at the top of its search engine, and it's very wrong a lot of the time.
They do tend to source though on that AI, just to say.
Oh, that's good.
On the right hand side, they do have the websites that they generally pull it from, I think.
Yeah, well, that's very good.
My knowledge, yeah.
Well, more of that, to be honest. That is a very helpful thing. But yeah, so I think just checking your sources and having a few reputable sites that you do get your information from and seeing what they're all saying, I think it's worth checking multiple sources just to see, to get a more balanced view if you need that. And training and education, I think, are really, really important. I think I made the cybersecurity comparison earlier, but I think that is the best. I think all the approaches that we take to cybersecurity should also be taken to misinformation fact-checking. Getting over that emotional response, because cyber criminals do use that urgency and sense of authority to get you to click on links. And I think the same is true of misinformation. So we're a trusted voice, but cyber criminals know that. So they will tend to spoof your website. And so looking out for like dodgy logos or slight changes in URLs and the S on the HTTPS sign, which means it's secure. Sure. It's a secure site. Just keeping an eye out for those things. And also like talking about it openly, because we did a really interesting podcast with PIR.org, and they're the organization that look after the .org domain name. And they said that they have a little cybersecurity meeting I don't know how often, but they have it. It's really fun. Like, people can bring things that they've learned about cybersecurity to it and just openly talk about it. And I think that's, again, us doing that little quiz. It was on the BBC website. It was a little quiz. How can you spot AI? I think it really opened our eyes to how convincing and how hard it is to spot these things. But it also had little tips on how to spot them. Mm. But it was a fun activity, but it really showed us why and how hard it is to spot misinformation. And yeah. I think it was a really good way of showing that, like, everyone is vulnerable to it, as Jan was saying. It's not just something, it's not a shameful thing to be.
No.
It's not embarrassing is the word I'm looking for. Like, we can all look out for it. And the more of us that do look out for it, the more empowered we are.
Exactly. Very well said. Josie, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. So I would say always, if you're sharing or resharing information, always fact check, obviously, as everyone's already said. And you can use websites like Full Fact, Channel 4 Fact Check and BBC Verify. And also when reading any information online, is understanding that you don't always know the intentions of the person who shared it or organization who shared it. And also, I think in that, being aware of your own, you know, you might be more vulnerable at certain times, and you might have your guard down at certain times more so than others. So being aware of your own state when you're consuming media and not resharing things, maybe when you're in that state of mind, and making sure that that you're just aware that you don't know what the intentions are of someone, and making sure you fact check before resharing. Especially if you're publishing, writing for a charity, understanding anything you share, having an understanding of exactly who that person is who's saying it and what their agenda or what their intentions are in saying that, that can also help. And then also being precise when you're writing and when you're relaying a fact or a quote or an opinion from someone, be exact with how you do that and don't misrepresent it in order to fit your own agenda or anything like that. Just be very accurate. That can help prevent the spread of misinformation or misinterpretation by other people through your writing. I'd also add about the digital literacy and media literacy of a team within a charity is when having those conversations, it's good to make sure people understand why fact-checking is worth taking the time. I think it's the same as anything like cybersecurity or digital carbon footprint or anything. That's always, people are more likely to act if they actually understand why and they're motivated to do it. Also having internal processes to prevent the spread of misinformation is making sure there's always an editor or always someone to go through and fact check it before it goes out. Even if it's someone giving a speech or anything like that, just making sure you're not spreading false information. Being aware of AI as a misinformation risk, maybe looking at past problems with misinformation, disinformation, and putting in processes to monitor how much it is a risk to your charity and responding as appropriate to that.
Well, that's brilliant. And from my part, I would say definitely agree with the stuff about lateral reading. Like I think Laura mentioned it, it's that almost always having other tabs to just fact check the whole way through. And those tabs that those websites Josie mentioned would obviously be super helpful. The training point is really strong too. In that, I think the difficulty is that I think we talked about this in the office, is that the media literacy is. So a few years ago, you had the Cambridge Analytica scandal, obviously, and we were really obviously very on top of the way that behavior modification was happening based on simple algorithmic decision making and like nudges, right? And so they basically get loads of data points about you as an individual. They can use that information to make perfectly tailor-made mass communications that will nudge your behavior towards a certain person. Towards a certain person to vote for them or certain party. And I think that was where we were at a few years ago or even a year ago. And when we were sort of training, thinking about being cognizant of these algorithms and the way that they might manipulate things. And we know that those algorithms largely depend on attention, right? So like if a post gains attention, then that post is that's what they want. They want as much attention as possible. And now it seems different because you had to train yourself to that. So you had to train your staff to be aware of that, aware of the sort of the pull of attention content, right, in an attention economy. And now with AI, it feels like the training has evolved again, because while the attention's still there, you have this entirely new beast that's doing things in different ways. You also have AI bots that are largely like driving some of this misinformation. And it's so I guess with the training point, I think Josie mentioned, I think both mentioned actually, but It's like, I think it needs to be constant nowadays. You can't have one training session a couple of years ago on media literacy and sort of expect that to stand, because it's so fast moving, it's so evolving that you need to be constantly up on it. So it's difficult, because obviously for smaller charities, that's not always possible. But, you know, there's loads of free resources out there where you can do media literacy training. Anyway, to move on slightly, I just wanted to ask how charities can address misinformation, disinformation and conspiracy theories when they're directly related to the individual cause or mission of the charity. I'll go to Josie to start with that one.
Yeah, so the first thing I would say that is a really interesting concept is pre-bunking, and that's found to be really effective as well. So pre-bunking is when you actually get ahead of any misinformation that spreads before it happens, and you can do that by predicting that it's going to happen. And we know that misinformation and disinformation are more likely to happen during election cycles, health crises and environmental disasters, because they can create a void of information when there isn't information about these things. That creates a void, and then people want to know the answer, which is then filled with misinformation and disinformation. So the best way to stop all of that happening is to put out information, correct, accurate information before any void of happens. And if it's during an election cycle, health crisis or environmental disaster, yeah, just reacting to that and sharing accurate information when you can. The other thing is to challenge and report inaccurate information. If on social media you come across people who are sharing misinformation or disinformation about your cause, you can report it to Full Fact, and you can also report it to the platform you find it on. And you can challenge directly the person or the account who's spreading this information or the sequence of challenging them is stating that the information is wrong, explaining why it's wrong, and stating what is true. So you're kind of giving them a new narrative, a new story to replace the inaccurate one, rather than just saying, oh, you're wrong. Yeah, so I think the final thing is being aware of the people on a charity team who are actually dealing with the impacts of misinformation, whether it's seeing it on social media and having to respond and having to correct people, or if it's actually in person, people acting in certain ways because they have the wrong information. That has happened before with charities, and within the charity, making sure those people are supported and their well-being is being taken care of.
Yeah, that's great. I think the point you made on sort of like how to tell people how to correct misinformation is really important, and something I quite like to talk about, in that there's something on social media, is like, it's a very toxic place. Obviously, I don't think that's a surprise to anyone, but sometimes when, you know, there's people who have misinformation, they're spreading misinformation, the rebuttal is always is not equally as toxic, but it's toxic too. And it's exacerbating that toxicity, in that they're sort of almost getting won over and being like, oh, look, I'm right, you're wrong. And so I think kindness can go a long way, particularly for people who are sort of, you know, people who are misinformed, or you know, to give them the right information in a way that is aiming to be productive rather than trying to be, what's the word where it's like one-upmanship or something like that. It just feels quite, you're making things worse by doing that, right? And I think the other thing is to accept, we're talking of conspiracy theories, which we haven't touched on too much, but kind of embroiled within this. And I think accepting that a lot of people find the world really scary. So for example, there's a reason when I think most people, listeners will know this, but there's usually reasons why conspiracy theories exist. And it's because people want more logical answers to the world, or more sort of answers that make sense to them. So 9/11 or COVID or climate change, there's always conspiracy theories around these big things because people don't want to believe that such drastic events can happen without these kind of logical defining things that they can change or that they can have more control over. I mean, 9/11 was, someone explained to me that a lot of people took safety in conspiracy theories because they didn't like the idea that people in a essentially a cave could cause that amount of destruction. So it was much more comforting to believe that it was the American government, you know, or something like that. And you sort of go, or COVID, again, you call that a hoax, because to believe that amount of sort of to think that that amount of devastation can come from a bat in a market in a small place in China, you know, these are far more scary. And climate change is obviously another one where it's nicer to believe that it's just a hoax or it's just a weather pattern. It's not man-made because, you know, again, we'd have control over it and we justify it so that we don't have to feel scared about it. So I think understanding that a lot of people who are maybe spreading misinformation or believing these things, and I think the belief is the spreading can be malicious, but believing in them can sometimes just be a sort of a consequence of fear around the unknown, about the way the world is. And so trying to understand that it comes from a place of fear or anxiety is a far more generous position to take, and then probably one that we should be more inclined to do, because so much of what we do now seems to just be a bit more bitter and toxic. And the other thing is, when you do come back, is always just have your own research and find good sources and explain in detail, like Josie says, be really clear about every part of it and avoid vague language and stuff like that. And then the last point I want to make on that is to sort of make some space for people with lived experience of the issues that you're addressing. So for example, just giving, I think so many of us speak with confidence about things we don't really know too much about. And I'm certainly guilty of that. But sometimes it's all right to just, I watched Question Time once where someone just goes, I don't know that much about that, so I don't really want to speak on it. And I kind of thought, well, that's so refreshing, because everyone feels that you have to have an answer about issues that are so complex, and we can't possibly have all that information. We can't know everything, but we still speak with confidence. So just to make space for people with lived experience, and just to be, it's okay if you don't know the answers, to do the research and to bow out of that discourse. You know, you don't always have to speak on everything, I think is probably something that I just spoke for ages. Anyway, Laura, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you've both covered it perfectly, really. I think a really good example, if people are looking for one, is one that I talk about on this podcast all the time. But the RNLI did a really good, they've done an excellent job of when their cause was being politicised, they did a really good job of taking, in my view, like the emotion out of it. But at the same time, saying what they do very clearly, making their position very clear, and backing it up. And I think that, I mean, it led to a record in their fundraising. It, as I said, it's about preserving that charity trusted voice, and being above reproach as much, you know, as much as possible. But I think it is possible to be that, it just with what we've talked about earlier.
No, totally. And are in a liar, just like leading the way with that. So shout out to them. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. So thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josie.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I hope it was helpful. We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.